Okay, then. There should be sheets around on the chairs. I actually have a spare one up here if anybody needs. And welcome back to part two. I will also note two other programs for people to be aware of. One at Shari Shamayim this evening at 8:15. It's a program that my Beit Midrash runs each year. We call it Haggadah Night. It's four thoughts on the Haggadah, each thought less than 10 minutes. It starts at 8:15. By that math, it should be done by 8:55. And it's just four thoughts on different parts of the Seder. I will be speaking about Karpas. Others will be speaking about other parts. It's a free program that's at 8:15 this evening at Shari Shamayim. And then the other is a four-part series coming up in May that will be at Beth Emeth. It's called History's Leading Anti-Semites, and we will be talking about four people who truly did not like us and what our reaction was and how we dealt with them. The first one will be the first caliph of the Almohad dynasty in the 12th century Morocco. The second one is going to be, if I remember correctly, Martin Luther. The third one is Empress Maria Theresa. And the fourth one is Fyodor Dostoevsky. So this will be four Wednesday mornings in May. If you have more information about it, just email me. My address is at the top of the source sheets, so you can see it there. So last time, we introduced the topic of the other villains of Passover by talking about the passage in the Haggadah that begins Arami Oved Avi, which we explain can be translated in different ways, but within the Haggadah it's translated as an Aramean tried to destroy my father. Ouch. It's not your fault, I know. These things do that. Okay. So, the people can remember to turn off their phones, that will be great. Now all our technology is with us. So, we said an Aramean tried to destroy my father, and that was a fellow by the name of Lavan, also known as Laban. And we noted how much a part he is of Jewish history, how he is the father of Rebecca and brother of Rebecca, father of Rachel and Leah, Rachel and Leah, and therefore, in a sense, the ancestor of two-thirds of the Jewish people. And we asked, so why is he identified as a villain? And we took a little bit of a digression to talk about how nations are formed and the need for trust and the need for a feeling that we are associated with others. We talked about shared language, shared customs, shared history, shared birthplace. And we talked about how what Lavan did with the swapping of Leah for Rachel effectively undermined the creation of the Jewish people and our sense of identification with each other. It created a sense of us and them. It goes way beyond squeezing 7 years of labor out of Jacob. And instead, what it does is it leads to great strife between Rachel and Leah themselves. It leads to the addition of Bilhah and Zilpah into the equation. It leads to the existence of multiple camps among their children. And we talked about how that would continue going forward. The way that they camped in the desert, the way they would be counted in the census. We continually break them up as the family of Leah, the family of Zilpah, the family of Bilhah, the family of Rachel. And ultimately, where that took us was the sale of Joseph. And how Shimon and Levi, sons of Leah, want to kill Joseph, the son of Rachel. We talked about where that desire to kill him came from. The us versus them. The feeling that in this family, it's always us versus them. So Isaac made it, and Ishmael got kicked out. And Esau got kicked out, not kicked out, but excluded from the blessings, while Jacob received the blessings. And now the sense is, again, it's an us versus them. Joseph thinks he's special. He's having these dreams. He's received the cloak from our father. He is the one who's being marked as special. Had they viewed themselves as all one unit, there would be no fear that Joseph is going to use his blessings in order to destroy them. But because there is a sense of he's on one side, and we're on the other, they say, well, we better get rid of him, or he's going to get rid of us. Right? This all sounds familiar? We did this last week? Okay, good. And then Judah comes along and says, well, don't kill him. Let's sell him. And on the one hand, you look at that and say, well, that's an upgrade, right? It's better than killing him, right? But on the other hand, it introduces the idea of we are going to profit from the ruin of our brother. He's being sold into slavery in Egypt. Don't kid yourself. No one thinks he's going to rise to anything from then on. So that he's saving his life, but gaining personally by doing so. It's this concept of the sale, and we showed how that plays out in the prophets, and particularly the book of Amos, where that kind of taking advantage of others to protect, to support yourself is harshly criticized by the prophets. And we said it's very hard to call Judah a villain, because he becomes such a powerful, wonderful figure for us. He rises from this, first in the story with Tamar, and then as we talked about defending Benjamin before the viceroy of Egypt, royalty comes from Yehuda, comes from Judah. So calling him a villain is really a very difficult thing to do. But in the context of our descent to Egypt, he is a major player. Because instead of saying, don't kill him, let's keep him, let's figure this out, he said, let's sell him. And so we talked about how, as the Midrash notes, the very next story begins, and Judah descended from among his brethren, that his brothers demoted him. They said, you're not a leader. And once the fervor of get rid of Joseph wore off, and they realized what they had done, they demoted him from his position of leadership. And that brings us to where we start this week, which is the story of Datan and Aviram. Who are Datan and Aviram? What do we know about them? Anybody know? Less familiar than Judah, that's for sure. Yeah? Right. Datan and Aviram would go on, not from the event that we're going to start with today, but ultimately would go on indeed to incite rebellion against Moses. But let's go back to their first appearance. They're not actually named at this stage. Almost no one is named at this stage in the book of Exodus. Take a look at source number one, please, on your sheets. At this point, Moses has been raised in the palace of the Pharaoh. And it was at that time. And Moses matured and went out to his brethren, and he saw their suffering. And he saw an Egyptian man beating a Hebrew man from his brethren. And he looked here and there, and he saw there was no one. And he struck the Egyptian and buried him in the sand. He went out on the second day, and behold, two Hebrews were fighting. He said to the wicked one, why will you strike your peer? The commentators note that the language in the Hebrew sounds like he hasn't actually struck him yet, but he's already calling him wicked just for trying to, just for planning to. Raising his hand is already sufficient. He says, why will you strike your peer? And the man replied, who appointed you as officer and judge over us? Are you declaring that you will kill me as you killed the Egyptian? And Moses was terrified. He said, but the matter is known. Achein noda hadavar. The Medrash is bothered by this story. I mean, there are numerous things to talk about within this story, obviously. But the Medrash is bothered by something in particular. What matter is it that is known? The fact that he killed the Egyptian. How does this person telling Moses this indicate the matter is known? How does how does this one person talking to Moses indicate now the word is out? Because it sounds like, the answer would be because it seems like, well, somebody must have said, right? But how could someone have said, Moses looked here and there and there was no man?
He saw there was a woman.
There was a woman. Oh boy. I didn't say that. Went clear. Is that what we're saying? Is that what we're saying? He missed it? He looked here and there. He didn't see anybody, but there was somebody watching. So that would certainly be one way you could take the story, but it's not the only way. Yeah?
It has to be the person who was going to be struck went out and told his friends what happened.
The person he saved then went and told everybody what he did. That's a second possibility, right? That's the survivor of the story. And it could be that he went out and told people. Well, the Midrash looks at it and it comes up with a third approach. which is remarkably painful. And it says, the victim, no, the one who had been the victim, the one who he saved, is actually the one speaking in this story. The one who is talking back to Moses. In other words, the one who he saved, the one whose life he saved, is the one who is now talking back to Moses. And this is a man by the name of Datan. Datan was the one he saved, and Datan is now the one saying to him, who are you to tell me what to do? Now, there are reasons within the text to make that association. It's not just a random thing. But it starts off with this question of, how would this person know if Moses looked around and nobody was there? And the assumption would be that the person he said he saved wouldn't go around, you know, telling everybody and endangering him. So there's reason within the text to assume this is in fact a man by the name of Datan. However, if you accept that version of the story, then you have to ask, what does Moses mean when he says the matter is known? It's not known. Datan was the guy he saved yesterday. He's now telling him, hey, you're gonna kill me. That doesn't mean the matter is known. So the Midrash suggests something different is going on when he says now the matter is known. It suggests that Moses was bothered by the same question that bothers us all the time about the whole Egypt story, which is, why was this necessary? Why were we sent down to Egypt in the first place? We were living in the land of Canaan, right? Why does God say to Abraham, your children are going to be slaves in a land not their own, right? They're going to be made to work, they're going to be made to suffer, and so on. Just let him stay in Canaan and be done with it. Why does God say to Jacob? Jacob wants to go down and visit his son Joseph when he finds out Joseph is there, but he's only planning it as a visit. Why does he say to him, no, 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 you stay there, right? And eventually I'll make sure that your body is brought back up. Why does God tell him to go? Why does God want this to happen? So take a look at source number 2. The answer of a Midrash. Moses thought in his heart, what sin did Israel commit to be the only nation to be enslaved? Of course, we're not the only nation to be enslaved, but it's describing the gravity of what happened to the Jews in Egypt. What sin did they commit such that they should suffer this? And when he heard the man's words, he said, they have harmful speech, lashon hara, among them. How will they deserve redemption? And therefore he said, the matter is known. Now I know why they are enslaved. The Jews are in Egypt because of the strife between them. Strife which has now transcended the tribalism generated by Lavan. This isn't about tribe versus tribe, we think, although I want to come back to that in a moment. But it's Jew versus other Jew. When you think about the level of corruption for the person Moses saved to be the one who turns around and attacks him like this, take a look at source number 3, a passage out of the Talmud speaking about the danger of harmful speech and the way people will use their speech to tear others down. The Talmud picks up on a line in the book of Kohelet, the book of Ecclesiastes, which says, there is no advantage for the one with the tongue. What does that mean? So the Talmud tells you a story. In the future, all of the animals will gather and approach the snake and say, the lion tramples and eats. The wolf tears and eats. Right? The predators benefit from what they do. But what benefit do you have when you bite? To which the snake will reply, and what advantage does the one with the tongue possess? Right? What do people gain when they speak damagingly about others? The same way that I don't gain anything when I bite somebody, that's the way people are also. Don't look at me, look at human beings. Now, of course, we understand snakes bite when they feel threatened. And frankly, people sometimes will speak harmfully about others when they feel threatened also. But the message is, there's no benefit. This fellow has nothing to gain by harming Moses. He himself is somebody who was saved by Moses, and that plays out in source number 4 in the Midrash there, where we actually get the identification of Datan as this as the person who talks back to Moses. This is the cause of our slavery. It's a statement that we are not yet a unified nation. there is strife between us. You could read it, and this is what I was alluding to before, you could read it as an element of tribalism. That Hanan Aviram came from the tribe of Reuven. Moses comes from the tribe of Levi. If you remember what we said last week, who were the ones who wanted to kill Joseph? Shimon and Levi, right? Those were the ones who wanted to kill Joseph. Reuven was the one who said, throw him in a pit, thinking that he would come back later in order to save him. Say if you wanted, you could make the argument that there's sort of a continuity there to it. Sort of, Reuven argued with Levi not to murder Joseph, and now the descendant of Reuven is saying to the descendant of Levi, you know, you're a murderer, you're a descendant of murderers type of a thing. You could sort of create that, but it's unlikely. It doesn't really seem to fit. One other thought that may explain what Datan is doing. Who does Datan think Moses is right now, at this point in the story? Right, the Jew who was raised as a prince, the Jew who was raised in the palace of Pharaoh. So he looks to him and he says, who are you? Right, I've been a slave. Yesterday I was being beaten by an Egyptian. Sure, great, you came along and you saved me from the Egyptian who was beating me. But you come out of the palace and you're going to make yourself a judge over us and tell us what's right and what's wrong. Come out here and, you know, build buildings with us, make bricks with us, and then we'll have a conversation. Right? It's possible that that's the motivation. But fundamentally, Datan and Aviram are never cured. Aviram is the other Jew in the story. Are never cured of this animosity for Moses and this strife. So I brought you source number 5, and Nancy mentioned it before. Later on, when they're in the wilderness, Korach launches his mutiny, his rebellion against Moses, and Datan and Aviram join the mutiny. They have no reason to be involved with the mutiny. The mutiny of Korach was a mutiny by people from the tribe of Levi who didn't have the power that Moses had, that his brother Aaron had, that his nephews had. And their claim was, we should be able to get power. Datan and Aviram are from the tribe of Reuven. They have nothing to gain. Nonetheless, they join in the revolt. And Moses summons them in source number 5. Moses summoned Datan and Aviram, sons of Eliab, and they said, we will not go up. Is it a small thing that you brought us up from a land flowing with milk and honey to kill us in the wilderness? Shall you also lord over us as well? They call Egypt the land of milk and honey. That's their statement. Oh yeah, it was great. It was wonderful for us there. Absolutely. So what you now have is the third villain, is Datan, who demonstrates the strife that the Jews have, which has gone beyond the basic tribalism and is now just sheer animosity towards others who are in a position of power, others who are not maybe exactly like them. That's what generates, as Moses observes, as recorded in the Midrash here, the need for us to be in Egypt. Diane.
So source 1 mentions that 2 Hebrews are fighting.
Yes.
Source number 4 or 5 says Datan and Aviram are brothers. We aren't named. The 2 Hebrews are not named.
Correct.
Possible. Is there a Midrash that says the 2 Hebrews are, in fact, Datan and Aviram fighting with each other, 2 brothers fighting with each other, which is just a continuation of this concept of brothers fighting brothers.
Right. What we saw did not emphasize brothers per se, although Datan was named in number 4, and other Midrashim do name Aviram as well. You're right. They don't really highlight the fact that it's 2 brothers fighting with each other, which is indeed, you're right, that continuing image of strife that we have. It definitely does add a note of depth to it when you identify them as brothers who are fighting. Thank you. So that's where we are now. But the question then is, what do we do about it? So what happens? What changes for the Jews in response to this that's going to make them eligible to leave? Rabbi Zalman Saruskin was a rabbi in the Ukraine in the early to mid 20th century. He wrote a Haggadah called Hashir v'Hashevach. And he says, that's why we went down to Egypt. We went down to Egypt to form, to borrow a phrase, a more perfect union. He said, other nations began in peace and harmony on their own land. You go back to what we said from Fukuyama in our first week. People who have a shared history, people who grew up together, people who have a shared language, that's the way they form. But he says, we didn't form like that. We actually ran counter to that. I brought you bullet points in number 6. When you think about it, generation by generation, Abraham versus the world, right? He's told to leave his family, right? Leave the idolatry of his father, leave his birthplace, and so on. He has to rebel against the place he came from. Then you have Isaac versus Ishmael, you have Jacob versus Esau, and you have Joseph against his brothers. In some sense, there's an element of necessity in this, so that the Jews won't be like everybody else. It's hard to buck the world, right? If you're going to accept this monotheism, if you're going to accept this new doctrine, this new system, this new way of doing things, you can't be like everybody else. And so, yeah, we had some chutzpah. We had difficulty getting along. But at some point, you have to grow up. You can't live life that way forever. A nation of revolutionaries isn't going to get anywhere. Yeah, someone commented, I forget who I heard this from, but it was very right. There's such an emphasis in the Jewish world on leadership, leadership training, and leadership projects, and who's going to be a leader, and so on. And we also need some followership. We have a hard time with that. Everyone's a leader. Everyone knows the best way to do things and is glad to tell you how. But that's what we needed was a sense of unity and a willingness to be loyal to a common leader. If you take a look at source number 7, a verse from Proverbs, a verse from Mishlei, which Rabbi Sarotkin quotes, in Hebrew, the key phrase is the second half of the sentence, Va'ach litzara yivaled. Ach, brother, litzara, at a time of trouble, yivaled, will be born. Out of trouble, you gain friends. Or the other way to read it would be, it's only a true brother who is going to help you in the time of trouble. But the point for us is that we learn humility and we learn to rely on each other in the course of the Egypt experience. And once we learn that, long after this thing with Datan, right, decades later, once we've demonstrated that unity, then it's time to go. At that point, it's time to get out of Egypt. And that unity is seen in multiple ways. If you take a look at source number 8, when the Torah says that the Jews cried out to God and God heard, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, rabbi in the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, leader of the yeshiva in Volozhin, made this point. He said, the Torah's text, which you read in the Haggadah, says, Vayizaku, they cried out to God. At this point, they've already been slaves, depending on how you count it, call it 210 years. There are different numbers, but call it 210 years. They've been down in Egypt. Is this really the first time they cried out to God? That's the first time that they cried out. So there are different answers, but look at his answer. Number 8, they cried out, they gathered to one place and decided to stand in prayer and cries. It was the unity of their cry that made things different. The point was that they did it together. And I think you see it elsewhere in the description of the story. If you flip the page to source number 9. When Moses first comes to Pharaoh, right? Moses and Aaron go to Pharaoh and they say, God said, time's up, let the Jews go. What's Pharaoh's reaction? Sorry? Not just no, and not just who's God, but what does he do for the Jews? Tells them, you're not getting straw. You have to make the bricks. You also have, you know, the bricks that you're going to use to build, you have to make them yourself by going to find straw. And you still have to keep up your quota. Look at text number 9, please. And the shotrim of the Jews. What is a shoter in modern Hebrew? A police officer. Is in mishtara, right? Is a police officer. It means somebody who is in charge and who has weapons at his disposal to enforce what he's doing. The shotrim of the Jews who had been put in place by Pharaoh's slave drivers were struck, saying, why have you not completed your quota of brick making like in previous times, not yesterday and not today? The shotrim are getting hit. In the Egyptian structure, you have the noksim, who are the slave drivers. Those are Egyptians. Then you have the Jews, who are the shotrim. and then you have the Jews who are the slaves. What did the Egyptians think was going to happen in order to make sure that the bricks would be made? What did the Egyptians expect to have happen? They thought the Shoterim are going to beat the Jews. Right? That's what they thought. They thought they created a capo system. They thought that they created a system in which the Jews will beat the other Jews into doing the work. But what actually happened in the text? The Shoterim absorbed the blows themselves. The Shoterim did not transmit it on to the Jews who were making the bricks, the Jews who were building the buildings. They absorbed it into themselves instead. They took it for their brethren. Not only that, if you take a look at source number 10, Moses and Aaron come out from Pharaoh when they've only made things worse, you know, as far as anybody could see. And they, the people, encountered Moses and Aaron standing to greet them when they left Pharaoh. And they said to them, God shall look upon you and call you to justice. For you have made our scent bad in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of his servants, placing a sword in their hands to kill us. They yelled at Moses and Aaron. They said, what have you done? But what did they not do to Moses and Aaron? What didn't they do? They didn't attack them. And they didn't turn them over. Right? They yell at them. They're furious. But there's a line that they won't cross. They're not willing to harm somebody else from the family. They're not willing to harm their own people. In contrast with what happened with the sale of Joseph, the animosity between the brothers, they're going to support each other, even in the event that it's to their own detriment. That's what says it's time for us to get out of Egypt. And Rabbi Sarutzkin points out something beautiful regarding the most maligned food of Passover. And I don't mean gluten-free cookies. We read in the Haggadah, after we tell the story, that Rabbi Gamliel says there are three things you have to mention, right, at your Seder. Right. Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. It's a Mishnah from the Talmud in Pesachim. In source number 11, I gave you the basic summary. Pesach, because God passed over the houses of our ancestors in Egypt. Matzah, because our ancestors were redeemed in Egypt. Maror, because the Egyptians made the lives of our ancestors bitter in Egypt. Straightforward? Which of these should you not really need to mention in your Seder? Which of these doesn't really need to be mentioned? Why the Maror? Maror was the whole experience. So I would have said, I can hear different answers here, so maybe it's not as clear as I thought. Rabbi Sarovsky, though, and I are on the same side. Pesach you mentioned because that's the miracle. Right? That's the miracle. God gets us out of Egypt. Punishes the Egyptians. The Egyptians say, okay, you can go, and they chase us out of Egypt. So I'm going to include Pesach in my Seder, not to mention it gives us the name for the sacrifice that's brought on Pesach, or the eve of Pesach. Maror, that's the bitterness of our slavery. That I understand. But Matzah, Matzah is really just the bread that we ate on the way out. That's it. You know, it's interesting. You grow up hearing that matzah is the bread the Jews ate as slaves in Egypt. But the Torah never actually, you didn't even grow up hearing that. Okay, good for you. The Torah never says it. The Torah does call it lechem oni, bread of affliction. But it never says, there's no description of the Jews eating it as slaves in Egypt. Rather, it's the bread that didn't rise, right, when we left. Why didn't the bread rise? Why wasn't there enough time? We knew 2 weeks beforehand when we were leaving. This is like what goes on in my house. Why are you not packed? Mind you, I'm the target of that question. I'm the one who's asking it. We knew 2 weeks beforehand, on the first day of the month of Nisan, we were told when we were leaving. On the 10th day of the month of Nisan, we were told, set aside the sacrifice, the Karban Pesach. We're going to be sacrificing it on the 14th, and then we're going to be leaving. There's no reason why we couldn't have made bread. Right? Like puffy, rising bread. Sorry?
It can only last a day, but we go scale the next day. And then make it the first of Nisan.
You think that your pita wouldn't be good? No? Maybe. But when I look in the Torah, I see a different account. When I look in the Torah, I see a different account. I'm told there that this was actually the way they were told to make it. Matzah has a particular message. You're supposed to have the matzah that way specifically. It's supposed to carry a message. And this is Rabbi Sirotkin's insight. It's a beautiful idea. He says, and this is the part about the much maligned food. What do you make matzah out of?
Water.
Sorry?
Flour
and water, right? Flour and water. Water is the liquid sign of division. It flows freely and apart. That's what liquids do, right? They'll fill out whatever space they're in. But also, if you go all the way back to creation, right? Day two of creation, the water is divided. The water below and the water above. It's the sign of division. And then flour, right? Flour just flies apart. You have these tiny little particles, and the air will blow them wherever they go, and they'll scatter, and they'll make a mess. That's what flour does. You combine them, and they stick together as a unit, like nothing else. Hence the problems people have with matzah. But you have to bake it fast, because if you don't, it will ferment. And at that point, again, it will spread outward. It will rise, right? You know the science of it, right? Fermentation involves the production of carbon dioxide. It gets trapped by the gluten. It creates a structure, and that's why bread rises. So what they need specifically is matzah as a reminder that they had to stick together, that they needed that unity, they needed that bond with each other, and so we are instructed to be careful to avoid chametz. Yes, the most salient characteristic of matzah is that which makes it hard for people to digest. Otherwise, it wouldn't be matzah. So this is, to me, a tremendous lesson we get at our Seder. We celebrate the dense matzah. And we see this show up, this attempt at unity and correcting the schism. We see it show up in the ensuing 40 years that the Jews travel in the wilderness. So, for example, I brought it in your sheet as bullet points in number 13. Anybody know the significance of the first bullet point, those two people, Bezalel and Aholiab?
They were designers.
They were the lead contractors on the building of the Mishkan, the temple the Jews traveled with in the wilderness. Bezalel from the tribe of Judah, from Leah, and Aholiab from the tribe of Dan. And if you don't have the sheets from last week still, Dan, remember, was from Bilhah, was Rachel's mate. So you're taking the son from royalty, from Judah, from Leah, and you're having him work with Dan, who comes from the maid, and not just the maid, but Rachel's maid, and putting them in charge of the national project. You're telling everybody, these have to work together. What's the significance of the second bullet point? Who are they? The two
came back with the favorable.
Right. They're the two good meraglim, the two good spies. Right? When they send one from each tribe, the two good ones are Joshua, who comes from the tribe of Ephraim, which is from Rachel, and Caleb, who is from Judah, from Leah. They working together. And then the third bullet point. Does that ring a bell? What's the common denominator between those? True. What unites Reuven, Gad, and Menashe? On the other side of the Jordan. Good. When the Jews arrive at the land of Israel, finally, right, they want to go in, and they try to cross through the land of various nations. They want to go through the land of Moab. Moab isn't interested. They want to go through the land of Edom. Edom isn't interested. But these are all family, and God says, I don't want you fighting with them. So instead, we end up going to Sihon, the Amori. They say, forget it. And God says, okay, you can fight with them. And we go to war with them, and we get their land. And the tribes of Reuven and Gad say, not Menashe, the tribes of Reuven and Gad approach Moshe and say, we have a lot of cattle. They had a lot of cattle, and they said, this is great land for cattle. We would like to keep that land. We don't want to cross the Jordan and go into Israel. We'll live on the eastern side of the Jordan. That's where we would prefer to be. And Moses is very angry because he says, 40 years ago we had people who said they wanted to stay in the wilderness, and look what happened. Right? We can't do this another 40 years. And he goes back to God, and God says, no, listen, they can do it as long as they agree that they will first cross the Jordan, fight with everybody else for the land, on the side of everybody else. I have to be careful how I say that. Not fight with, but fight on the side of everybody else for the land, and then they can come back over, and they add half of the tribe of Menashe. They didn't ask for that land. The half of the tribe of Menashe that goes there is assigned to go there. What's going on? Reuven is from Leah. Gad is from Zilpah, Leah's maid. They're going to be the ones on the eastern side of the Jordan. And God says, okay, but I'm throwing a son of Rachel in there also. Menashe is going too. And then eventually the tribe of Dan also gets a portion. They're Dan being from Bilhah. And it's interesting because they're all the firstborn. Reuven is the firstborn. God, that's its own note. But the point that I want to show you here is that that you see attempts to try to correct the schism. The villainy that leads us to go to Egypt is the us versus them. And there's an attempt to try to bring us together first through the Egypt experience and then through steps like these in the wilderness. So far, so good? We're clear? Sandy?
Could matzah be symbolic of this?
Sorry?
Could matzah be symbolic?
That's exactly the idea, that matzah represents this kind of unification. The dense matzah that sticks together, we are supposed to be like that. That's exactly the idea that Rabbi Sorotzkin promotes. Yes?
So can I just ask you, at the beginning of the Seder, when it says, this is the bread of affliction, which our forefathers were forced to eat in the land of Egypt, So, like you were just saying before, that there's no line in the Torah that talks about the Jews eating matzah in Egypt. So why does the Haggadah say that?
Right. So, good question, but it's not quite what the Haggadah says. And I thank you for asking it, because it gives me a chance to clarify it. No, it's very close. The line is, Ha lachma anya diachalu avatana, we can all sing it, be'ara, 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 mitzrayim. Right? This is the bread of affliction which our ancestors ate in the land of Egypt. No, it's not your fault, because this, you're right, it's the impression we get. It's the impression I always had, was that this was the bread you ate as a slave. But it didn't say that. It said that we ate in the land of Egypt, and we did on that last night, because we were told to. It could be that it was eaten at other times also, but the Torah never has an explicit statement of, this is what you ate as a slave. It's a fascinating point Rabbi Sorotzkin makes, and I would have missed it entirely. But there's another catch. Not just because we have 20 minutes to go, but because we're playing both sides of the fence here. I've been playing both sides of the fence here. On the one hand, I'm telling you all about how we need unity, and how the schism is terrible, and it's why we end up in Egypt. And all of that is true. But there's a problem, and I really should have brought it from the sheet from last week, and I didn't. So I will just refer back, because I happen to bring a copy for myself. Do you remember what we said about the census in the book of Numbers and the ways that they were broken up? We said that the census reads, Reuven, Shimon, Yehuda, Yisachar, Zebulun, Zebulun. Right? That's the list of the heads of tribes in the census. In other words, all the sons of Levi, of Leah. We skip Levi because he's not in the census. And then you had the sons of Rachel. And then you had the sons of Bilhah. And then you had the sons of Zilpah. In other words, when they did the census, they listed them all individually. Right? Broken out by their mothers. If we're really trying to solve the problem, why does God do the census in that way? We talked about the Degalim. We talked about the camps that that the Jews had in the wilderness, the four different camps. And we said that we stuck together all the sons of Leah, and we needed to throw in one from Zilpah in order to round out the set, because you didn't have enough, because you didn't have six, because again, Levi wasn't in there. But again, you broke out the sons of Leah as being apart from everybody else. If you really wanted to cure the problem of strife, then why did you continue to honor tribal identity at all? Right? What did we think we were doing? Not only that, there's a midrash which, if you look on your sheet, now the sheet that you do have, the source number 14. The Midrash builds on verses. There are many verses that contribute to form this. I didn't bring you all of them. But there are verses in Psalms and verses in Isaiah, as well as in Exodus, that support this Midrash, which says, in number 14, the sea was split into 12 channels. You heard that before? When the Yam Suf split, when the sea split, it was split into 12 channels. As it says, God says to Moses, raise your hand over the sea and split it. It didn't mean split it just in half, but split it into 12 different channels, and each tribe has its own path through the sea. There's a lot of support for this in various texts, even though it's not explicit at all in Exodus. In number 15, I had a great cartoon that I really liked, but it would have pushed us onto a second page, so I didn't put it, I just put the link. But you probably received it at some point. It's the Moses Transports one, you know what I'm talking about? It's very cute. It's worth looking at it. It's and then you'll forward it to your grandchildren, you know, and other people you know. But it's got, you know, the sea split, and there's a truck going through, and the ad on the back is Moses Transports, and there's a little road sign on the side saying sea split next 3 miles or whatever it is. It's very cute. But they're actually it's split. It splits into 12 channels. But again, why are you honoring tribal identity if you don't like it? If it creates a schism, then you should say no. Let everybody go together. Not only that, we said that each tribe had its own flag. And if you take a look at source number 16, Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra, writing in the beginning of the 12th century in his commentary on the flags, which are described as having otot, signs, he says, there were signs on each flag. Our predecessors have said Reuven's flag had the form of a man due to the midrash on the Dudaim, those mandrakes we talked about last week. The ones that Rachel asked for from Leah, and Leah said, you took my husband, now you're going to take my mandrakes. And Judah's flag had the form of a lion, because Jacob compared him to a lion. We are specifically highlighting that which makes each tribe different. No, we just learned. We're all one people. We're doing the opposite. Not only that, take a look at source number 17. I brought you again a series of bullet points. Over and over and over again, biblically, you find the image of 12 stones. Specifically 12 stones to represent 12 tribes. The first one that I brought you there at Sinai, Moses builds an altar out of 12 stones, and it says, not an altar, a monument, excuse me, L'shnei Masar Shiftei Yisrael, because there are 12 tribes of Israel. The next one, the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol, of the high priest, has 12 stones representing the 12 tribes. It even has the names. There are all sorts of mystical texts that explain the association between each gem and each of the tribes. Joshua, when they cross the Jordan, sets up a monument of 12 stones to mark the crossing of the Jordan. He then uses another set of 12 stones to build an altar on Mount Ebal. And then the last one that I brought you there, the story of Elijah, of Eliyahu Hanavi on Har HaKarmel. Elijah says the Jews have gone to worship with the priests of the Baal, this Canaanite god. I'm going to have a showdown with them. And he builds up this ancient altar that he fixes up with 12 stones. Right? If you remember the story, right? There's a big showdown. Then the prophets of the Baal try to bring fire down from heaven to consume their offering, and no fire comes down. And then he recites a short prayer, and the fire comes down, and consumes the offering. And the Jews all say, Hashem hu Elokim, Hashem hu Elokim, God is the right God. And that lasts for a little while. But again, it's the 12 stone image. And even though there is an element of unity hinted at in that image, because the 12 stones come together as one, I brought you an example in source number 18, the Midrash regarding Jacob. Right? Are you familiar with the story about Jacob and the 12 stones that were his pillow or his protection? When Jacob is running away from his brother Esau, Esau wants to kill him. So Jacob camps out, and he puts stones by his head. But it's very interesting. At night, it says, he put avanim, stones. But the next morning it said, Vayikach et ha'eben asher samar ashotav. He took the stone that he had placed by his head. Says the Midrash, the stones bound together. They became one as a symbol to him that he would have 12 children who would all ultimately unite. Nice. It is nice. But why do you need to honor this division? What are you accomplishing? What would you say? Why do we preserve the division, which is so dangerous and so counterproductive in the Jewish mission?
Identity.
What do you mean by identity?
Each tribe is unique and has unique strengths, and together they all come. Then they form a unit, which each has a certain characteristics that you need to make one nation.
Good. So one issue is that the tribes have different traits. They develop in different ways. They develop different characteristics in their families and in their traditions, and that can make them unique. Interesting to note, Reb Chaim Vital, the lead student of Rabbi Yitzhak Luria, also known as the Ari, who was a major Kabbalist in Tzfat in the 16th century. Rabbi Vital said, each tribe has its own spiritual character, and therefore each tribe should actually have its own nusach, its own format of prayer that's appropriate for the members of that tribe. Our problem is I have no idea what tribe I'm from. I know I'm not a Levi, but that's about it. But the idea is that each tribe should have really its own mandate, its own spiritual mandate, and should be particularistic in its spiritual life, even as they are bonded with everybody else in their national life. And so that's one argument, is that you have to honor the tribes because each one has its own traits. Right? This is something, of course, that, you know, is going to be part of a bigger Canadian theme. If you want to talk multiculturalism, this is very much part of that conversation. It's the traits that they bring that are unique, and that's one element. But Pearl said something else first, which is identity. It's also about just your sense of identity, of who you are. Being Jewish is centrally about our covenant. It is centrally about our Torah. But it's also about being part of an am, being part of a nation. And that doesn't only mean the nation as a whole. It also means about the part of the nation that you come from.
Actually, when Yaakov blessed the children, I don't know why it's called blessed, because it was not blessing.
Some of them it was.
But it was really on each one, their character.
Yes.
And and he was talking to each one also what will be with them. So he did mention the characteristics of each one of them.
Yes, absolutely. Why it's called brachot is a good discussion. But he highlights the traits of each one. In a class elsewhere, some of you may have been there, I talked about the Brother Daniel case. Anybody remember what the Brother Daniel case was? Okay, so for those who don't remember, Brother Daniel was Shmuel Rufeisen. Shmuel Oswald Rufeisen, was a Polish Jew pre-war. It's a very long story, but he had terrible experiences through the war, including betrayal at one point by other Jews. He ultimately was saved and raised by Christians. And he, after the war, decided he wanted to become a monk and took the name Brother Daniel. And then, in the 1950s, he decided he wanted to make Aliyah. He was going to be a Carmelite monk and go to be in their monastery on Mount Carmel. And he wanted to make Aliyah as a Jew. In other words, that he should be qualified under the law of return, and he should be identified as a Jew, even though he was 100% a practicing Christian. And it caused this big fuss in Israel. One of the first "who is a Jew" debates was this story with Brother Daniel. The agent of the government for Aliyah, who he had spoken to, just said, "Listen, just be quiet. You'll be able to get there. Just don't demand that we write Jew on your passport." And he insisted. It was a whole back and forth. But Rav Aaron Lichtenstein later wrote an essay related to the Brother Daniel case, and he said, "To be a Jew without being connected to other Jews, meaning seeing yourself as part of this population, is not merely disorienting, it's wrong." He pointed out that the Talmud has a text that we're supposed to say to somebody who wants to come convert to Judaism. And we speak to the person about, yes, adopting rules and laws, but we also speak to them about adopting a nation with a history, becoming part of a people, such that a person who converts to Judaism is going to sit at the Seder with everybody else and say, "Halach ma'anya diachalu avhatana. This is the bread of affliction that our ancestors ate." It's not their biological ancestors. Their biological ancestors might have been Egyptian. Nonetheless, that's what they are going to say. And Elokeinu v'Elokei Avoteinu, our God, God of our forefathers, and so on, they are considered to be Jewish and to become part of a nation. But it's, again, not only about the national identity, it's also about the specifics, the parents, the grandparents, the great-grandparents, the people whose customs we continue to practice, whose memories are honored on yard sites, whose names we perpetuate in our children, right? All of that is part of identity. And you can't just erase that and say no more tribes. You can't. They come from Reuven, they come from Dan, they come from Gad, they come from whichever of the tribes they come from. You can't erase that. Identity matters. So those are two points: identity and special traits. But I think there's a third point which is really important and people miss. For any of you who heard a class from Rabbi Ziering, who was with my Beit Midrash for the last few years, so he and I discussed this idea quite a bit. There's a psychological reason for maintaining tribal identity, and that is it gives you the security to experiment and to diversify. Meaning, look at Jewish food. This is Rabbi Ziering's point. I really like this. He said, "Who would have imagined 100 years ago that sushi would replace gefilte fish as the quintessential Jewish food?" Right? Or that hummus would no longer be limited to chickpeas, right? But instead would include edamame and black beans, and that every supermarket would have it. You go to a supermarket in the middle of nowhere and you can find sabra hummus, right? Even the traditional Jewish foods have become non-traditional. You can get gefilte fish made with salmon, right? Can you imagine what they would have thought in Europe about gefilte fish made with salmon? Kishka is artificial, which on the whole is probably a good thing. Chopped liver has been replaced by guacamole, right? You think about it. The cultural swapping is a sign of a new generation's fearlessness. It's like property rights. Honoring ownership enables people to share. If I don't recognize ownership, then people are going to be afraid to let others onto their property. Who knows what's going to happen? Once you say, no, your ownership is protected, then the boundaries become easier to cross. Preserving separation empowers blending. And the same thing is true for food. When our identity is weak, then we need what you could call gastronomic purity to bolster our sense of who we are. And immigrants will cling to their traditional diets, not only because those are familiar, but because they are comforting. It's proof we're still the people we once were in the old country. We're sticking together. It's only when we are secure that we'll diversify. Still keeping kosher, it is not about dropping that, but it's about saying there are a lot of different kinds of food that are kosher. So this, to me, is a third reason why we need to maintain tribal affiliation. It gives a sense of security. If you say to the Jews who got out of Egypt, "You're no longer Reuven, you're no longer Dan, we're getting rid of your identity," just the opposite. They'll hold on to it more. They'll be firmer about it. They'll rebel, effectively. You need to give people that space. So that what ends up happening, oddly enough, is that we end up preserving the tribalism that Lavan created. Right? We started with two questions. Our questions were, How did Lavan seek to uproot everything? And why are we blaming our grandfather so harshly? And we said, nation building requires a shared feeling, and Lavan undermined that trust. He created this us versus them type of an approach, which led to the fear of Joseph, which led to the sale of Joseph and the attempt to profit from it. And the mutual antagonism was displayed again in the beginning in Egypt, and we saw it with Datan. Descending to Egypt was meant to solve the problem by triggering unity, and it did. The Shotrim stood up for everybody else and absorbed the blows themselves. The Jews gathered together in their prayer to God. But we still, after we got out, and even though we eat matzah every year, nonetheless, we retain Lavan's tribalism. And you could view it as a concession to the reality he created, to say that, well, we're just stuck with it. You could read it that way. Or you could say, this was the divine plan. God wanted there to be these tribes with their special traits and their special identities. You can read it either way. I'm not sure which way is correct. But fundamentally, we keep it, and we say, it's important to know our roots, it's important to use our unique talents, and it's important that we benefit from a secure, unchallenged identity. I brought you one last quote that I just love. Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein, the author of the Aruch HaShulchan, a major, major work of Jewish law. In the introduction to one of his sections, he writes the following. I'm going to tell you the Hebrew. I didn't put it on the sheet, but I'll tell you the Hebrew first for the Hebrew speakers. Tiferet Hashir, he kishahakolot mishunim zemize, v'zehu ikar hani'imut. He says, the splendor of a song is when the voices are different from each other. That is the essence of its appeal. I thought that was a beautiful idea. So we have these different tribes and these different identities, and it hasn't always served us well. But we retain it to the extent that we honor the identity, so long as we recognize that even with these different identities, we still have to stand together as the matzah, as that one nation. I saw a hand back there. Yes?
I'm just going to say, to answer with the question that you asked before, I think another interpretation of the way I kind of got what I got from in the end one is a song.
Yeah.
In order to have harmony and to sing with different voices that come together, you have to acknowledge and to respect each
yes
of the orchestra.
You got it.
And as long as you keep one another.